Today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online is brought to you by Native Deodorant. Do what I did and make the switch to Native today by going to nativedeo.com/realghost or use promo code REALGHOST at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/realghost or use promo code REALGHOST at checkout for 20% off your first order.
You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know, but after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking the Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
Today on Real Ghost Stories Online, a very special October Halloween treat for you. Laura DiDio, one of the reporters that went into the Amityville house with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Yes, right there. Play-by-play action of what occurred on those fateful days of investigating the Amityville Horror. You're going to hear it here on Real Ghost Stories Online today.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802. Or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You're about to enter the world of the unknown, and quite possibly, the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
That it is, and 855-853-4802 is our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online to share your real ghost stories with us. We'd love to hear them. You can also write it on our website, realghoststoriesonline.com. And this is a listener-supported show. It has been from day one. If you enjoy the program and you want to keep us on the air, we encourage that by becoming an extra podcast person. We affectionately call them EPPs. When you're an EPP, you get bonus content. You get a brand new EPP bonus episode every single week. You get access to our archive of more than 300 of them. You get advanced episodes of the show ad-free. You get our ebook or audiobook, both Amazon bestsellers. You make out with a lot of good stuff right away if you're into ghost stories. That's how we keep this program on the air. It's only $5 a month to be an EPP. Or get a month free and add that to your list of goodies when you sign up for an annual membership. You can do it at ghostpodcast.com, or if you prefer to use Patreon, great app right there. If you like that, go for it there. It's patreon.com/realghoststories. Today on the show, it's a little bit different than a normal episode of the program. Normally, it's you guys and your stories. Today, we're going to take you into an interview in its entirety that I did recently with Laura DiDio. Now, Laura DiDio was a Channel 5 reporter at the time of the Amityville Horror. Yeah, in Amityville, New York. She went in and investigated the claims of George and Kathy Lutz, along with Ed and Lorraine Warren, to document it. She is one of the few people still alive to this day who can account and recount exactly what happened when they went in to the 112 Ocean Avenue residence those fateful days to try and figure out what was going on with George and Kathy Lutz. She knew the Amityville Horror before it was the Amityville Horror. Now, this is an interview that I did for The Grave Talks, our other program, a little while back. And on The Grave Talks, we aired portions of the interview, and then the rest was for Gravekeepers. Today, we're getting into the month of Halloween. We have COVID going on. We are all under enormous amounts of stress. Today and tomorrow, actually, we're going to be giving you the entire damn thing. nothing is, you know, subscribe or anything to get extra. We are going to play the entire thing. It's so long, though. It's like a 2-hour interview. So today, hour one of our conversation with Laura DiDio. If the Amityville Horror is something that has fascinated you like it has me since childhood, I remember sitting on my porch reading it, you know, in those you know, there's chairs with like the elastic on them, and then you sit in them too long, and then your whole leg and butt looks like you got big marks on it. Yeah, I don't know why I went down that road. But I remember reading the book one summer, so enthralled with it. And to be talking to someone who was that close to the story, you are going to find this to be a very fascinating conversation. It is one of the most fascinating conversations I think I've ever had with anyone in my life. So happy Halloween, everybody. We're getting closer and closer to it. Today, part one of our interview with Laura DiDio. Laura, welcome to the program. Tell us, how did your involvement in the world of the paranormal all begin?
Well, first of all, my own mother was psychic, okay? And it wasn't something that we talked about a lot. It was just something that was there. She sort of knew things before they happened, and it wasn't always good stuff. Like, she woke up one morning when we were at our summer home in Maine and said she had a terrible dream about our family dog, Freddie, and we were all crying. And 2 days later, the dog got run over and killed by a truck. And she brought home one time this book, The Ghost Hunter by Hans Holzer, which was on the bestseller list. And I picked up the book and I read it and I was fascinated. And of course, everybody in their family had a book about ghost story. I'm sure you had it in your family as well. Mm-hmm. But I was always fascinated by that and the fact that my mother herself was psychic. So that kindled my interest in the supernatural.
When it comes to having a family member that is psychic and having that level of sensitivity, sometimes we see that passed down from generation to generation. Did you at that time have any inklings that you had any type of ability that way, whether it be psychic or empathically?
No, I didn't. Certainly not to the degree that my mother did. Although I will say, over the years, it's, you know, if you hang around people who are talented to that, you know, to that degree, mm-hmm. you sort of some of it will rub off on you naturally.
Sure.
And I'm not claiming any great ability, but if you hang around with musicians long enough in a studio, you sort of pick something up just by osmosis.
Sure.
So over the years, that has to some degree happened to me as I've worked with psychics and been on cases and done research. You open yourself up to that and you become more aware. Mm-hmm. Because to a certain degree, we all have a psychic sense. It is a sixth sense, like speech, touch, sense, hearing, feeling. It's just a case of developing it.
Sure.
Now, that said, you know, a lot of people can play the piano. That doesn't mean we're going to be, you know, Mozart.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who play basketball, but you're not going to be in the NBA. That said, you can develop it to the best of your ability.
Sure.
You know, I go to the gym and work out. I'm not going to be a bodybuilder, but I can get stronger.
Sure.
So anybody out there, you know, can develop it just by paying attention to what's all around us. I think that sixth sense that we all have gets lost in the hustle and bustle of everyday life, especially today when we've got social media and, you know, you're trying to balance a checkbook, run around to get to work, you get caught in a traffic jam. those things. So we're not paying attention to things. But certainly little things that happen every day, like deja vu or something pops into your head, I should call so-and-so, et cetera. And as we get into talking about the Amityville horror story, I have a very interesting experience in that vein to recount to you about just something that happened with myself and Lorraine Warren that popped up out of the blue.
I'd love to hear about that.
Long after the Amityville horror, the events of the Amityville horror.
Let's talk about Ed and Lorraine for a moment. You had contact with them and you knew who they were and had some professional interaction with them as a reporter prior to the Amityville case, correct?
Yes. Well, I was a student at Fordham University majoring in communications. In other words, journalism, broadcast, you know, with an emphasis on both print and broadcasting and also radio. So being at Fordham was Fordham University, WFUV, was one of the first 50,000-watt FM stereo stations in the country, going back to 1947. And Ed and Lorraine, well, Fordham, of course, for those who don't know, is located in the Bronx. And that's really only about 30 miles away, 30, 40 miles away from Monroe, Connecticut, where the Warrens lived. Mm-hmm. For most of their life. And at that time, prior to the Amityville horror case, the Warrens had made a pretty good name for themselves locally in the tri-state area as paranormal researchers. They did not yet have the national reputation that they would later develop. And again, with my interest in paranormal research, they were one of the first people that I wanted to contact. I also, ironically, I also interviewed Hans Holzer, who was based in Manhattan. He had a pretty big name for himself as well, having authored many books, including the best-selling Ghost Hunter. So I had interviewed Ed and Lorraine on my radio show, and also Ed and Lorraine had been interviewed several times on Channel 5 News and other local media outlets in the New York City area. Lorraine was known as a light trans medium, which was different from, say, Ethel Johnson Myers, who worked with Hans Holzer, where she was a deep trans medium, which meant she went into a full trans state where she was out of it. Lorraine was always, as a light trans medium, conscious and working, but sort of in an altered state. But she was aware of her surroundings. Mm-hmm. Where a deep trans medium went someplace else and had a spirit guide.
Sure.
So the Warrens were always very forthcoming. They were always very helpful. And, you know, just nice people to be around. Ed called himself a demonologist so that when he and Lorraine would work a case, he was, you know, he took the lead position while Lorraine was more of the empath, mm-hmm. picking up perceptions and the feelings because she was the one who had the psychic abilities.
Sure. Back to the conversation in just a moment. First, our supporter today, it's Native Deodorant. I love this stuff. I believe reading labels is key and knowing what you are putting on your body is very important. And my Native Deodorant does just that. It doesn't just block odor. It doesn't just have good things on the label that make you go, oh, that sounds good. It really truly is. It's made better. Native has ingredients you've heard of like coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch. It's also vegan, never been tested on animals. The aluminum that is in other deodorants, it forms plugs in your sweat glands and it keeps you from sweating. Yeah, jamming aluminum in your sweat glands. Hey, great idea, right? That's why Native never uses ingredients like aluminum, parabens, sulfates, or talc. Switching to aluminum-free deodorant doesn't mean you have to sacrifice on odor protection either. Native's going to keep you smelling and feeling fresh all day. It's not like, oh, we'll sacrifice this, but I'm going to be smelly. Not at all. With over 10 scents, including rotating seasonals, Native is something for everybody. The most popular classic scents are coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and citrus and herbal musk. My favorite of all of them, I really kind of dig the cucumber and mint. I really do. It's a good, refreshing smell, and it just kind of keeps you good all day. Native is risk-free to try. Every product comes with free shipping within the U.S., plus free 30-day returns and exchanges. You can also see why many people love Native by checking out their 14,000 five-star reviews. Yes. Well, we all look at reviews these days to make our decisions, and you're not going to find anything bad there about Native. It is all good. Check it out for yourself. Do what I did. Make the switch to Native today by going to nativedo.com/realghost or use promo code realghost at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedo.com/realghost or use promo code realghost at checkout for 20% off your first order.
So obviously you got to know them a little bit through the interviews and understand what they were doing. And the tense of this is this is not the Ed and Lorraine Warren that we know of today. This is prior to all the books. This is prior to the movies. This is prior to all of that. This is very much, you know, towards the beginning or in the part of their career where they were basically this material was being put together and their research was going on.
Yes, but I have to say, when you say the Ed and Lorraine of today or the present, mm-hmm. that the public came to know because of the Amityville Horror, because of the Conjuring movie, they remained remarkably unaffected. They would still answer their phone, mm-hmm. you know. They didn't go Hollywood.
No, not at all. I guess I meant more so just in the terms of notoriety of how well known they became, but I completely agree of how they always were Ed and Lorraine.
Yes, they were, and you know, it's amazing because when you talk about the notable personages in the field of the paranormal, there's always a lot of professional rivalry, mm-hmm. if you will, as you have in any field. And Ed and Lorraine, one of the things that was most amazing about them, and you have people, as in any field, people who will, people have their critics and they have their proponents. But what I will tell you is that with Ed and Lorraine, from the get-go, their primary goal was always to help people. So to give you an example, when I first started working at Channel 5 through an internship that I got because I was a student at Fordham. And then I was working there as the internship progressed and I became a part-time employee and then a full-time news assistant while I was still at school before I had graduated. And I was actually working on a series on psychic phenomenon when, believe it or not, in January, late January, early February, the news about the Lutzes fleeing 112 Ocean Avenue broke in New York Newsday. And it just so happened that the two things coincided. And the news director at Channel 5 at the time, Mark Monsky, said, oh, get that story. So shortly after this article appeared in New York Newsday, where the Lutzes had held a press conference with William Weber, all of a sudden, they disappeared. And nobody could find them. And you have to go back to 1976, where we didn't have the internet. You didn't have mobile phones. Hard to imagine, I know. Where did they go? It seemed like they just went underground. And William Weber at the time, he had been acting as their spokesperson. And so we contacted him, and there were plans afoot where he was going to be working at the time with ABC Eyewitness News, the local station, and a group of white witches to hold a seance in the house, and also a vampirologist. And he said, well, when I contacted him, he says, you folks at Channel 5 might be able to come along as well. Then I guess at some point the Lutzes had broken off contact with William Weber, and that just dissipated. So at that point, I had contacted George Lutz. I had called into his company firm, his family firm. They had a surveying firm. And so I called out there and I left a message, said who I was. And I said, you know, I have some experience working with and interviewing other people, you know, professional paranormal researchers, and I'd like to help you and your family. And I left the message with the people who worked for him. And he called me back, and I arranged to meet him on a Saturday at his the surveying firm. But I didn't tell anybody at the TV station because I was afraid of over promising and under delivering and getting fired.
Sure.
Okay, I was just a lowly news assistant, just starting my career.
Yeah,
and even though I just had this menial job and I wasn't yet, you know, I wasn't yet out of college, I didn't want to lose it.
Sure.
Have my career go down in flames before it started. So essentially, I went out there the next day and met with George and Kathy and for 4 hours. And they said, okay, that at the end of the meeting, and I listened to their story, and I came back convinced that something had really happened to them, because they felt they seemed very sincere and very frightened. So unless they were, you know, the Meryl Streep and Robert De Niro of their day, and had totally convinced me, and maybe I was just, you know, a lot of people listening to this might think, well, you know, she was a gullible 19-year-old who desperately wanted to believe, and there probably was an element of that too, because this was a really juicy story. But the other thing that people have to understand is that irrespective of whether or not they were telling the truth or fabricating, you know, a huge hoax, the station was going to go with that regardless. At that point, everybody in town, all of the news outlets, wanted that story. You know, New York is the number one media outlet.
Yeah.
This story was happening. It had all of the elements that you would want. There had been a sextuple homicide in that house just a year before. And those are rare. I mean, George, Ronald DeFeo Jr. had killed his entire family.
Sure.
His four siblings, his parents, in this very upscale suburban neighborhood, in this beautiful home. And then you had a family that was saying, that had moved in and out of the house within a month, saying it was haunted. And this was also just a year or two after The Exorcist movie had scared even non-believers.
Yeah. I want to talk about the DeFeo murders as we kind of move down the line here of things. And I have a couple questions about that initial interview with George and Kathy. With the DeFeo murders, even prior to that, To your knowledge, and I know you've done your digging as a reporter, you know, on this when you were reporting on the topic initially, and I'm sure in years prior, has there ever been anything about the history of the property or the house or anything that raises any eyebrows as to why this house was, for lack of a better term, haunted?
Not really. Okay, so at the time, once the Lutzes moved in and out very quickly,
mm-hmm.
they themselves were trying to dig into that. And of course, when William Weber, who was trying to get an appeal for Ronnie Jr.,
mm-hmm.
And he came upon the Lutzes. And you have to say William Weber did a really good job for, you know,
yeah.
on Ronnie's behalf at the first trial. And then when the Lutzes contacted him and told their story, that was a very novel approach to say, you know, to try and get an appeal, saying,
sure.
you know, hey, the devil, you know,
yeah.
the devil could have made Ronnie do it.
Yeah.
At that point, it does become, you know, rather murky. Now, certainly, there's no doubt that Ronnie was on drugs. Certainly, there was no doubt that there were troubles in the family. And Ronnie's story has changed a lot over the years. So he is not what anyone would call a credible source. So at the time, there were rumors that, you know, they had masses in the house. Now, the family was very religious. They did have, you know, it's a matter of record that they had, you know, the holy statues on the lawn.
Sure.
There's nothing about that. But, you know, there were rumors that they had a mass set in the house, which, you know, some Catholics, you know, have done. There's nothing that unusual about that.
No, especially at the time.
Candles had, you know, but you know, wind came up even though the windows were closed and the candles were blown out. There was nothing to support that as a fact. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But no. And I did research on the property itself. The original house had been moved there, and it is true that the there were Native American burial grounds there. Again, that's not unusual. My hometown of College Point, Queens, which is about 35 miles away from Amityville, you know, further in Queens,
sure.
also had a lot of Native Americans that lived along the shoreline.
Sure.
And you would have burial grounds. But we're not talking about the Native American burial grounds that you saw in Last of the Mohicans or Jeremiah Johnston. Okay?
Yeah.
The Native Americans did bury their dead along there. And even up here in where I live in Massachusetts now,
mm-hmm.
we do have some Native American burial grounds that look more like what you and I would think of as traditional cemeteries. Now,
sure.
when I went into the house afterwards, several months later in January 1977, with Hans Holzer and Ethel Johnson Myers, who did go into a deep trance, and the spirit, her spirit guide came through, we did hear an Indian, a Native American boy came through, and he was upset because he said that some kids, local kids, had found his skull and were kicking it around like a football, which is also entirely possible.
Sure.
But do I think that that was the subject of the hauntings? Now, when Lorraine went into the trance during the seance on March 6, 1976, when we filmed it for Channel 5, she felt that it was actually not so much the ghost of the departed DeFeos, but she felt like it was a demonic entity that, as she said during the seance, it came from the bowels of the earth. That's what she said during that seance.
Something that's almost feeding off of all the negative energy that was so recently present in that
yes.
home. Yeah.
And I think when you have something, this is my personal opinion now, not Laura DiDio reporter.
Sure.
And I like to make the distinction between what I witnessed as a reporter and a professional observer and what my personal opinion is, just as Laura DiDio citizen. Mm-hmm. My personal opinion is that when you have events like that, where people were violently killed, especially children, and let's face it, the DeFeos, at least the kids, were murdered in their sleep, and those kids ranged in age from almost 18 down to 9, the four kids, two boys and two girls. Ronald DeFeo Sr., they know that he actually sort of half rose from the bed. And his wife, Louise, who was next to him in the bed, she was also killed where she slept. One thing that nobody understood, including the district attorney, was how they never really woke up.
Yeah.
So to speak, and how nobody else in the neighborhood heard it, even though it, in Suffolk County, the houses are not as close together as you would have in a densely populated neighborhood, like say downtown San Francisco or Queens, New York or Manhattan. But they're also not, it's not a rural neighborhood.
Yeah. It's a
place, and you're right on the water, so sounds, can carry.
A place where today, if you went and fired off that same gun in a home, you would certainly hear it next door and probably several doors down. That is one of those things that I want to ask you as Laura, the citizen, looking back on this and all these years later, do you have any? And I don't say explanation, because I don't think any of us will ever have the explanation, but any reasoning that you've worked out in your mind as to how that was possible? Because that certainly is one of the biggest mysteries in this whole thing, is how no one could have heard those gunshots, how all those people stayed in their beds, no drugs in the toxicology reports. How did that transpire like that? Any insight or thoughts on that?
No, and it's interesting that you should say that, because I have gone back and interviewed the people who did, the DA and the person who did, the book,
mm-hmm.
With the Suffolk County DA who prosecuted Ronald DeFeo.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have an any explanation for it either. I mean, one of the last things in the book that they had written about that was, I often wonder about the dead DeFeos and how come they didn't, how they didn't wake up.
Yeah.
And there were no drugs in the system. In their system with the toxicology, so they hadn't been drugged. Why were they all, found in the same position?
It's
inexplicable.
It is. It's one of those things. The only thing I can do as someone who's told ghost stories, read ghost stories, and have heard, thousands of them over the years here on this show, I can only, when I get a story and someone says this happened, I can only say, well, I've heard something similar from other stories. So the only thing I could add into that, having heard so many stories, is other stories where sound at times in haunting situations, seems to be able to be sucked in or not dispersed as it normally would be. And it makes you wonder, just as I have stories where people call in and say, my child or I was screaming my head off from the room, but no one else in the house could hear me. And they were the next bedroom over. It's that principle. It's for whatever reason. Sometimes there are these cases where the entity or whatever is in the house is muffling the sound that no one else can hear it right next door. I'm wondering if something of that nature was happening in the home to keep those sounds from being heard throughout the home. That's what I'm wondering.
Yes, and the other explanation, the other thing that any logical person would say was, well, maybe he had an accomplice.
Sure.
And of course, one of the theories has always, was always that, he hinted himself, Ronald DeFeo Jr., during, his time there. On the stand and since, and in the many interviews that he's given, that his sister Dawn, committed one of the murders. And there's never been any credible evidence that was the case.
Sure.
So,
it shall remain a mystery.
Yes, it is. So assuming, of course, and that was dispelled in the book,
yeah.
Written about it. And of course, anybody who wanted to know, the best book was High Hopes, The Amityville Murders, which was written by Gerard Sullivan and Harvey Aronson of Newsday. And the last page of the book, Gerard Sullivan writes, I still think about the DeFeo case, and I'm quoting directly right here, especially about the children. And I wonder about the questions that were never answered. Did any of the victims wake up? If so, why didn't any of them defend themselves? Why were all six found face down in death? Why didn't anyone hear the shots? And this is, this is from the defense attorney, the Suffolk County DA, And he had no explanation, and he pored over every bit of evidence. Now, of course, in talking, Gerard Sullivan, has since passed away, but several years back I did interview Harvey Aronson, who was for many years he was a Newsday editor. He co-wrote the book with Gerard Sullivan. He was for many years also a journalism teacher. He quite frankly thought that the whole idea of the haunting was pretty much a money-making hoax. And of course he's entitled to his opinion. And if you go out to Amityville, you can imagine what a pain in the neck that is, with people driving by and coming by and, busloads of tourists and things every time something new comes out. The books, the movies, etc.
You want to tell people it's a hoax if you live there to try and get them to stop frequenting the road and the nice neighborhood. just give them some.
And they've changed the windows on the house.
Yeah.
They've changed the address, and and it gets referenced in TV shows, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things.
Let's go back to that day when you met with George at his firm and you had that 4-hour conversation with George and Kathy there. At this point, when they were getting ready and you were talking to them about doing the investigation with the TV station, was their relationship with William Weber and Kaplan, had that been broken off at that point?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about that for a moment, because two of the biggest dissenters, obviously, in the whole case, and the people that are the quickest or had been the quickest to say this is a hoax, this is not true, were those two. It seems. And I wonder if you can give any insight into that, just as yourself, as a person and as a reporter, with some of the facts that have been gathered, as to why do you think it is that those two, after the fact, after they began to publicize this more and more, and these two weren't involved in that. One can, from a distance, look and go, oh, they seem scorned because they weren't directly involved with the publicity of it. And maybe they're jealous, and now they're going to try and get their piece of it by saying this is all a hoax. And there's 30 different arguments, I guess, you could make on that. But what is your insight into why that relationship did break off between Weber and who the vampirologist Kaplan, who also wrote the book?
Well, I do think... it was a case of, you know, being scorned. I had talked to Kaplan on the phone at the time, because, of course, I was trying to get the story as well. Mm-hmm. And at that point, both Weber and Kaplan, when they were still involved with the Lutzes, were conduits to that.
Sure.
I have to say, I thought the idea, the notion of a vampirologist was a little out there.
Yes.
Myself. William Weber was never anything but nice, to me. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do whatever I could to get the story. But yeah, I think that they were scorned, you know, that they were scorned. By the way, William Weber and his partner, Bernie Burton, were respected attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you go back and you look at the record, and you actually read Gerard Sullivan and Harvey Aronson's book, High Hopes, Weber did a very credible job in trying to defend Ronnie DeFeo. Mm-hmm. In what was, you know, something, it was a very, very uphill battle. It was,
yeah,
like the 101 tasks of Hercules, you know, because they had Ronnie DeFeo pretty much dead to rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Kaplan was trying to make a name for himself and establish himself as a vampirologist. Again, you're in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Home of P.T. Barnum.
Yeah. What was the reason when you talked with George and Kathy, why did these relationships break off, where it had been so, you know, very much in depth, where Weber's speaking out for them initially, and then all of a sudden it all falls apart? Did it have to do with...
Well, Weber, I think it was a case, Weber, Weber had his agenda. George and Kathy went to Weber because he had defended Ronnie DeFeo, and they wanted to find out if Ronnie DeFeo had any experiences, you know, in the house, or what had gone on. And I think William Weber, for his part, wanted to get an appeal for his client. And then, as they all admit, they sat down with several bottles of wine, and the Lutzes did play an audio tape for me. And they said, listen, we're not proud of this. And on the tape, they were going to put the house in a trust and almost charge admission for it. And, you know, they were concocting this tale about, you know, the haunting, and they were going to exaggerate certain aspects of it. And I vividly recall at one point George saying, okay, I don't want the kids involved at all in this. They have to stay out of it. And William Weber's response was, no, of course, God bless them. And I vividly recall the God bless them part. And when George finished playing the tape for me, he said, we're not very proud of this. do you still want to talk to us?
When
and I said, well, of course I do. And I said, actually, I said, I think that the only thing you should be concerned about at this point is your family. And at this, George and Kathy were living with Kathy's mother, Joan, because they had left the house, they had left Ocean Avenue, and they didn't go back there. So they had moved in with her mother. And it was a nice little bungalow house, but, you know, they were cramped. You know, Kathy's mother was a working woman, you know, very middle class. She had a good job at Grumman, the aircraft company, and Kathy's sister lived there as well. And Kathy's mother was very, you know, Irish Catholic, religious, no nonsense. And at that point, I said, you need to be put in touch with someone who can really help you. And I originally reached out to Hans Holzer, who was not available. And then I called Ed and Lorraine Warren. But getting back to your original question, I think the reason it fell apart between Weber and George Lutz, who was obviously the stronger of the two in terms of George and Kathy, was a control issue. Both of them were vying for control. And William Weber was sort of acting as the mouthpiece, if you will, for the Lutzes in trying to set up this publicity campaign, having Channel 7 Eyewitness News go in with full-blown, you know, white witches and the vampirologist, etc.
Sure. On that tape, when I don't know if you can recall this part of it, because it gets down to a pretty specific part when you're listening to it. Was Weber leading them in the idea of this admission scheme or the let's overpublicize this? And then George and Kathy are sitting there going, well, you know, let's kind of, you know, and they kind of go along with it. Or was it George and Kathy coming to Weber going, hey, we have this idea. What do you think? The order in which that occurred, I think, it would be very interesting for a lot of people who always cite that specific night of a lot of bottles of wine. It's a hoax. That's what you hear so often without getting into the details of it.
Well, as I recall, it was Weber who came up with the idea of putting, because he was the lawyer.
Yeah.
Putting the house in a trust. And sort of, you know, making it like a haunted house attraction, charging admission. But then the Lutzes were coming up with ideas to actively promote and exaggerate things that had happened in the house.
Okay.
So, in terms of their experience. If you're asking whether or not they were actually sitting there as just passively letting William Weber lead them by the nose, the answer was no.
Okay. When you had the conversation with them after they had broke their relationship off with Weber, what was their goal at that point when you were talking to them? Obviously, they're in a really weird situation here. They're not in their home anymore. They don't feel comfortable going back to the home. They have the story of these horrible things that occurred in this home. And then they had this conversations with Weber and Kaplan about the possibility promoting this and finding a way to profit from it, or the possibility of, and then that falls apart and they're talking to you. What's their mindset? What are they wanting at this point?
Well, that was interesting because I was, you know, and I have my, I'm looking at my original notes and my original write-up from the time. And I was listening to this incredible story unfold, and here I am, and I had to make a determination about whether or not they were telling the truth or, you know, just trying to perpetrate a hoax. Either way, I knew that the station was going to go for it because it was going to be ratings. Okay? So at the time, I thought that they were on the level, because since that one and only press conference with Weber, they had not sought any publicity. In fact, they were hyped. They were really hiding. And they appeared to be genuinely terrified. The other thing was, you know, Kathy's mother, again, this woman, you know, had a regular 9-to-5 job. She had a good job. She's a very religious woman. You know, there were holy statues and crucifixes all over the house. I felt like I was in a church. That's how big some of these statues were. Mm-hmm. They did it, you know, they came clean right away. They did not have to play me that tape, that audio tape.
Yeah.
And at that point, remember, William Weber was not on, and Kaplan were not on TV or in the news denouncing them. Nobody knew that this thing was going to be as big as it was. Let's face it, you're in New York. There are a lot of ghost stories and haunted houses. There's no way, there would have been no way to predict that this one was going to take off.
Sure.
They said that they would give me the exclusive. The other thing that struck me at the time, though, I will say that was odd, was that when George was talking about the experiences, and you know, Kathy talked too, but when Kathy would, she was very, very soft-spoken. So you almost had to strain to hear her. Okay? Mm-hmm. When they described some of the things that happened, it was like every type of paranormal occurrence, except for Frankenstein and the Mummy.
Yeah.
And Count Dracula had been visited upon these people. You know, it was incredible. So, the following week, what happened was, I had called Hans Holzer. So at that point, we had to get a credible paranormal researcher in there.
Sure.
And Hans Holzer had also done a full documentary on Channel 5 in the late 60s on the Cafe Bazaar, which was a discotheque in Greenwich Village, mm-hmm, that had been the former home of Aaron Burr. And when they turned it into a discotheque, people would be out there, you know, and spaced out on marijuana, acid, LSD, and they would be seeing actually the ghost of Aaron Burr, although nobody knew it was Aaron Burr at the time, on the dance floor. And they'd get freaked out. And he had gone in with Sybil Leek, who was a white witch and also a trans medium, and had done, and it was quite a successful documentary. So Hans wanted to do a serious sort of documentary approach to this. And of course, Channel 5 just wanted to go in and do a down and dirty, you know, newscast, and, you know, inexpensively.
Sure.
So Hans sort of said, passed on it because he had other things to do. So at that point, I called the Warrens, and again, a lot of people in the paranormal research profession will, there's a lot of professional jealousy and what have you. But I have to say, the Warrens never asked for any money. What they did say, their first thing was, when I told them about it, they said, how can we help? I explained the case to them. Lorraine was on one phone and Ed was on the extension. And all they asked for, and this is the God's honest truth, was money for gas and tolls. And at the time, when you had to drive from Connecticut down to New York, there were about 5 25-cent tolls, and they would really foul up traffic to stop for these tolls before you got to the Whitestone, and then the Triborough Bridge, et cetera, to get into Manhattan.
Sure.
And we said, sure, we'll pay for gas and tolls, you know. Yeah. And so they came down the following week. It was Wednesday, February 23rd, and Steve Bauman was the reporter. This was before Marvin Scott. And Steve Bauman was an Emmy-winning investigative reporter. He did a lot of the political reporting and investigation into corrupt politicians, and he did things on the horrific conditions at Willowbrook, which was a state institution, mental institution. Geraldo Rivera also worked on that as well. Mm-hmm. And we went in with Lorraine and Ed, and it was really kind of funny because we had to meet George to give us the keys. And it was a cold, rainy night. And again, we are working without any mobile phones or anything. We had phones in the car, in the crew car, and we were supposed to meet George to get the keys to get into the house. And he wasn't where we were meeting him. So Lorraine and I were trying to call him at his mother-in-law's house, and we kept we were in the phone booth. Yes, we really did have phone booths in those days. And we were getting snap, crackle, pop on the phone booth.
Mm-hmm.
We literally could not get through.
I want to continue this line of the story, but I want to ask a quick question in the middle of this. In your course of investigating this story and over the years with it, have you had personally issues with getting the story out where technical issues would occur beyond right then and there, but just over the years surrounding the story, have you had any strange things where, like, well, this is an odd occurrence of when I'm just trying to tell the story of issues prohibiting that otherwise normally don't?
At the time, yes.
Okay.
And there was a specific instance, actually, when I went back into the house in January, the following January, with Hans Holzer, where it was actually, the house was empty at that point. His camera froze.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 25 or 30 degrees, but it was not enough. And Hans was very surprised as well. But his video camera froze, and it shouldn't have been cold enough for it to freeze.
That happened
several times.
I had to ask because I know that there's been a lot of stories about this. We've had it on our own show where we're just bizarre things have happened when the topic has come up. We were talking the other week. I was having a conversation with Christopher Edward McKinnell, Ed and Lorraine's grandson, and we were touching on Amityville. And it's rare that our phones ever cut out here. Immediately, we start talking about Amityville. Boom, our line just goes dead. And it's this weird thing. I know George had some stories, you know, towards the end of his life of having issues with getting some of his stories out. Just the weird technical glitches around it. So I wanted to ask you if you had any experience in that line as well.
Well, no. I mean, it was just actually basically at that time.
Okay.
So it was weird, but I do remember that particular night, you know, where we were, you know, Lorraine and I are at that phone booth.
Yeah.
Then we actually went to the police station because they were keeping tabs on the house.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people were trying to get into the house, if you can believe that.
Sure.
There was no George Lutz, and Steve Bauman was laughing at me. He says, if this story falls through, you know, you're going to be stuck, you know, washing windows at the TV station. And What happened was we went down to the Amityville police station, and when we showed up, we were greeted by a chorus of groans because, you know, before I'm actually reading from my notes here. Before the town really, before 112 Ocean Avenue became infamous, the members of the town's law enforcement body had led a fairly peaceful existence. And the cops there were, you know, was making their life miserable. Well, they spent a lot of their time shooing people away from the property. So the desk sergeant on duty, I'm saying, he was less than impressed with my request that he call Chief Bill Kay at home, just because he knew, you know, he had George Lutz's number.
Yeah.
And the chief had just gone off duty and he was at home eating his supper. And so he didn't want to disturb him for a bunch of Ghostbusters. But Lorraine and I stood there and we weren't moving, so he reluctantly made the call. So at that point, George agreed to meet with us at the local pizzeria. And then, so that's how we finally got in touch with him. But I had been standing there in that, Lorraine and I had been standing in that one, we went to several phone booths around town. And I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And Lorraine just looked at me and smiled, and she was saying it was, you know, demonic interference.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was doing was I kept slamming, you're standing in front of one of the vending machines and you put your money in and nothing comes out, and so you kick the machine. I was hitting the the phone.
Yeah.
And nothing was happening. It was really quite frustrating.
Sure.
But there was no explanation for that. And George, at the time, you know, George, when we finally did meet him, and Ed and Lorraine were meeting George for the first time. And Ed was trying to get George to elaborate on exactly what had happened to the family when they were in the house for the 28 days. And George was very reluctant to get into it in any detail. One of the things early on, George Lutz was not an easy interview. And in fact, he and Ed early on clashed. At one point, they almost came to blows in one of those early interviews. And George told us that he didn't even want to, he wouldn't go back onto the property at all. And that even if he sat out in front of the house, he would get physically ill while he was waiting for the film crew. So he gave us the keys, and Steve Bauman, who was a very persuasive reporter, wanted, obviously, George to come into the house with us, and he couldn't persuade him to come in at all. So we finally went in with Ed and Lorraine that night, and Lorraine told us to, you know, meditate for a couple of minutes and be quiet before we went in. Just to get ourselves in the right frame of mind. And then this is really kind of funny. And she turned around and asked Steve Bauman and myself if we wanted to carry any of these, you know, various Catholic sacramentals with us when we went into the house. Now, I'm Irish and Italian, which almost pretty much guarantees that I'm Catholic, which I am.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve was Jewish. I'll never forget this. I was sitting next to Steve in the back seat, and Lorraine was in the front seat. And Lorraine turned around and says to Steve, she offered him a crucifix. And I said, Steve, would you like a crucifix? And Steve reaches across from me and grabs the crucifix from Lorraine and says, can't hurt. It was just one of those funny moments, you know?
Yeah. At that moment, you know, why not? Yeah.
So we went into the house, and the Warrens told us to stay with them at all times and not to go wandering off. And we were no sooner in the foyer of the house when, and 112 Ocean Avenue, it's, as I said, it's a big house. We went into the side entrance where there's a driveway rather than what you would normally think of as the front of the house. And it's a very big foyer, and you have the dining room off to the side and then the living room, but there's a center staircase right there. And Lorraine said she was struck with the feeling of an onerous, oppressive presence. I didn't feel anything, I have to tell you. Basically, it looked like, you know, a nice big house. The furniture itself, the Lutzes had purchased much of the furniture from the DeFeo family, or what was left of the DeFeo family. Louise DeFeo, her father was the one, her father, Mr. Briganti, had actually made the house payments on there, on the house. And he owned a car dealership in Brooklyn. And he was very distraught, obviously, that he had lost his daughter and his grandchildren. So they had sold a lot of the furniture to the Lutzes.
Sure.
And to be quite frank, a lot of the furniture was what we would look at now as, you know, sort of kitschies 70 type furniture.
Okay.
You know, so if you look at like the Brady Bunch things, you had those infamous ceramic lions that were there.
Sure.
You know, but it didn't look, it's not like what we think of today, you know, granite countertops. Most of it was, you know, formica and things like that. It was nice, but it was not grand or opulent.
Sure.
Still, for the 70s, it was very nice. But it looked like people had just gone out for the day. To give you an idea, the gingerbread house from Christmas was still on the dining room table.
Okay.
All the food was still in the refrigerator. The liquor was still in the liquor cabinet. Ed was asking, we toured the premises, and Lorraine basically said the worst spots in the house were the second floor sewing room, the third floor playroom, the basement closet, you know, that so-called red room, which was depicted in the movie as the portal to hell.
Sure.
The kitchen. And then in the master bedroom on the second floor, Lorraine did go into a light trance for the cameras. Ed asked the questions. And at that point, Lorraine said that the water had a lot to do with the force that pervaded the house. And at that point, Lorraine picked up on the fact that Louise DeFeo had died in that room. Steve Bauman, at that point, you know, we were in a rush, a bit of a rush to conclude the interview so that we could get back into Manhattan station in time to edit the film for airing so we could make the 10 o'clock news broadcast.
Sure.
So then, you know, that was Wednesday night, you know, and as expected, what happened was the station was deluged with calls from everybody who wanted to spend, you know, who wanted to know more about it, and people who wanted to spend, people were calling saying, could we spend the night in the house? So there was no doubt that we were going to do a follow-up story.
Sure.
And, you know, the Lutzes called us to say, wow, they were really pleased and astonished with the results that the Warrens had obtained in their short visit there. So by this point, the Lutzes, you know, had preempted any, you know, this, you know, Weber and Kaplan and the sort of white witches, that was all over and done with. So during this time, the Lutzes and the Warrens were, you know, making plans, you know, to get together and really sit down to talk about what had transpired. Because in order for the Warrens to help the Lutzes, they had to know what had happened in the house.
Sure.
And as I said, George Lutz in particular was reluctant to give Ed Warren any useful information. Mm-hmm. And if you saw the movie, The Conjuring, the actors who played Ed and Lorraine, the actress who played Lorraine nailed the part. Well, she was able to actually draw on, you know, she met Lorraine, so
sure.
She could draw on thing. The actor who played Ed didn't have any such luck because Ed had, you know, passed away.
Sure.
But Ed was much, so he played Ed as a much kindly, you know, much gentler, laid back version of Ed. Ed was a very straightforward, straight talking, you know, pulls no punches kind of guy. He's a very, very nice man, but, you know, he was a real straight shooter.
Sure.
And he was very witty and didn't hold back. So Ed was ready to walk out of there and go home before they even sat down to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And Father Pecoraro, Ray Pecoraro, was there that night as well. And he was the priest who had gone in to try and bless the house.
Yeah.
And had been told to get out. So finally, you know, the Lutzes, you know, did start to open up to them about some of the events. You know, but it was, you know, it was in fits and starts.
Do you have any insight as to why that might have been, why George was so reluctant to open up when they had been wanting help with this? They were the ones who were asking for some assistance here. Why the hesitation then when the help arrives to be open enough to receive that initially?
It was more George. I think, you know, they had been through, if you think, it's probably, you know, if I had to guess, it would be post-traumatic stress.
Sure.
Syndrome. PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting because on Friday night, February 27th, actually, when the Lutzes and the Warrens got together with Father Pecoraro, and I was there, but then I left. The next night, Saturday, I was actually out walking my dog, and George Lutz called the house, and my mother took the call, and she actually talked to George for about a half an hour and spoke to him. Mm-hmm. And my mother and Lorraine were about the same age, and she, again, my mother was psychic, not that she didn't go into trances and speak to spirits the way Lorraine did, but
sure.
My mother was one of those people that, you know, was easy to speak with. So I came back, and George asked if I was free, could I come out and talk to them? So he seemed very anxious to talk. So I drove all the way out to the island. That's the type of thing when you do when you're 19, 20. You don't think anything about going out at 10 o'clock at night.
Yep.
And Kathy's mother was out there, her brother Jimmy and the sister-in-law. And I was there until 3 in the morning. And again, they played more tapes with, you know, Weber and Burton. And, you know, at that point, you know, it was more details about how the house would have been put into, they would form a corporation. And then the four of them, you know, William Weber, Bernie Burton, and George and Kathy Lutz would negotiate books and movie deals. And according to the tape, Weber foresaw that they could get several books and several movie deals. And then at the end of that tape, the Lutzes told me they were ashamed of ever having considered the idea. And then they asked for my advice. And I said, you know, I think that the only partnership you should worry about at this point is your marriage. Mm-hmm. And then Kathy's brother and sister-in-law joined us at that point, and they said that strange things had been happening to them when they visited the house. They had just been married, and I guess the money that they were using to pay for the caterer had disappeared, like $1,800.
Oh, wow.
Things like that. So, and Kathy had an aunt who was a nun, and she felt ill when she went into the house. So they also said, I remember Danny telling me, and of course there was the story about all the flies congregating. Mm-hmm. But that could just be the weather, too.
Sure.
I have to say, my house, all of a sudden here in the Northeast, we've had a lot of ladybugs mm-hmm. that congregate. You know, George also said the door had been ripped off the hinges, the screen door, but we didn't see any evidence of that. And there were some things, quite frankly, that George exaggerated. He was saying that the DeFeo's maid, you know, had a nervous breakdown and was going into a mental institution. And that never really happened. I mean, she testified at the trial. It wasn't really a maid as such. She was a friend of the family, you know, a friend of Louise DeFeo's, and sometimes she helped out with the housekeeping. Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't have a nervous breakdown as such. She was understandably upset after the murders.
Sure.
And wanted to take time off. But, and there was a lot of back and forth at the time. It was, George was very high strung and he could be very controlling. So, he wanted, you know, we were going back and forth with him at Channel 5. Mm-hmm. You know, he would try and put conditions on things when we could go back and forth. And at this time, from that whole week, from the end of February, early March, until we actually went in there for the so-called, what I called the psychic slumber party on March 6th, the thing was taking on a life of its own. The Lutzes started inviting people to go into the house that night. The folks at Channel 5 invited another reporter from WNEW Radio, which was our affiliate radio station.
Sure.
The Warrens invited a couple of people. So all of a sudden, instead of it just being the Warrens and Channel 5, you know, we had a cast of about 20 people.
Yeah.
Which was not necessarily conducive to a great seance.
Sure. It becomes almost a tour than it does a seance at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember showing up that night at the house, and it was lit up. All the floors were lit up, and Alex Tanaus, who was part of a psychic New York Institute for Psychic Research in Manhattan. He was, he looked like, almost like a vampire. I didn't know who he was. And he appeared at the one of the side windows there. I almost jumped off the doorstep because he had, you know, hawk-like nose, dark circles under his eyes. I was just so startled.
That right there is going to wrap up our day one of our interview with Laura DiDio. I'm not going to say part one because you guys are getting the entire thing, all of it. On tomorrow's episode, we're going to pick up exactly where we left off and go to the end and hear more about the adventure, the thrill, the horror that, in fact, was the Amityville Horror before anyone knew exactly what the hell was about to hit them with Laura DiDio here on Real Ghost Stories Online. It's a special Halloween month gift to you guys. So be tuning in tomorrow for the rest of this. If you like our program, keep us on the air. Become an extra podcast person. Sign up at ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.